Still, the regiments came pouring over the skyline in thick but orderly columns. They wheeled and fell into the pattern of the whole, as though a single mind directed them, the way shoals of fish or flights of migrating birds react to unspoken commands. Indeed, this seemed to be not a gathering of individuals, but a single organism, sprawling but well coordinated. Hassan watched it and shivered in the noon heat of the valley. Upon the north bank, all movement ceased, and a massive stillness settled over the serried ranks of black warriors. The stillness seemed more menacing than the preceding movement, and an expectant hush filled the valley, a sense of mounting tension which became unbearable until Hassan swore and made a gesture as though to rise. "I will not pander to the whims of a savage. This is an insult. We will go. He must come to us if he wishes to talk." But the gesture never matured, and he sank back upon the cushions and fretted in silence until his brother spoke. "It seems," said Omar, "that the world we know has changed, brother. What was true yesterday is true no longer."
"What is your advice?"
"Let us find the new truths and examine them. It is possible that we shall still find something to our advantage in all of this." On the hills opposite, there was a disturbance, a stirring of the ranks, the way the tops of tall reeds move when a lion passes through. The sheikhs strained their eyes, calling out to their guards for advice of what was happening. But any reply was lost in an ocean of sound. The earth shook beneath the stamp of hundreds of thousands of feet. The air quivered with the drumming of spears on shield. And from the densely packed hills, a single voice from the throats of that black multitude roared the royal salute to the king. The storm of sound rolled across the valley and died in the echoes against the sky in the southern hills. Again the stillness and silence. Then a large war canoe with 50 rows aside was launched from the sandbank and shot across the green waters towards the island. A man stepped out onto the white beach and walked alone up the bank to where the sheikhs waited beneath the fig tree. The very fact that he came without an escort was a mark of contempt, a sign of his strength and invulnerability. He wore a cloak of leopard skin and sandals upon his feet, but he carried no ornament nor weapon. He stood tall and gaunt over the sheikhs, and they seemed to shrink in significance beside his bulk. He looked at them with the fierce yellow eyes of a bird of prey, eyes that seemed to rake their souls.
"I am Manatazi," he said in a soft, deep rumble. "I am the Black Beast."
They had known enough not to be surprised that he spoke their language fluently. "I am Hassan, Sheikh of Sofala, Prince of Monomotapa, and Viceroy of the Chan Emperor."
"You love the yellow metal."
Manatazi said it like an accusation, and Hassan was taken off balance. He blinked and glanced at Omar. "Yes," said Omar, "we love it."
"I will give you enough to glut you," said Manatazi.
Omar licked his lips, an unconscious expression of greed, and he smiled. "You must have much of the precious stuff," Hassan asked. This direct approach to trade was distasteful. This man was a savage. He didn't understand the niceties of diplomacy. Yet gold was worth a little gaucherie, especially in the quantities this self-styled black beast hinted at. "Where does it come from?"
"From the treasure house of Lannan Hyakinus, Grey Lion of Opet, and King of the Four Kingdoms," said Manatazi.
And Hassan frowned quickly.
I do not understand you.
Then you are stupid, said Manatasi.
And Hassan flushed dusky rose beneath his brown skin, and the retort rose swiftly to his lips, but he felt his brother's cautionary fingers press his wrist.
Explain it to me, said Omar. Do you intend to war with Opet?
I will destroy them, destroy their people, their cities, their gods. I will leave not a trace of them, not a single living one.
The giant negro began to tremble. A little white spittle wet his full purple lips, and a light sheen of sweat greased his battered features.
Omar smiled delicately.
We heard of a battle at a place named Set.
Manatasi roared, a sound of pain. He leapt towards the sheikh, and from under his cloak he drew the clawed iron hand and held it in Omar's face. Omar scrambled backwards and clung to his brother.
Do not mock me, little brown man. Do not mock me, or I will tear out your liver.
Omar moaned with terror, and sweat ran down into his beard. Peace, peace, Hassan intervened hurriedly. My brother meant only to remark that the legions of Opet will be difficult to destroy. Manatasi gulped for air, still shaking with his rage. He turned away and walked to the edge of the island and stared down into the water. His shoulders heaved and his chest panted for air. But slowly he calmed himself and came back to them.
Do you see them?
He pointed to his army that still darkened the hills.
Numbers alone? Hassan asked. Will they be sufficient? You challenge a mighty foe.
I will show you, said Manatasi.
And he lifted the iron claw. Instantly one of his war captains ran from the canoe and knelt before him. Manatasi spoke a few words in the Vindi language and pointed out at the river. The captain sprang to his feet with an expression of joy lighting his dark face. He saluted, went bounding away down the bank, leapt into the bows of the canoe, and was sped swiftly across to the north bank. The sheikhs watched with puzzled interest as a new movement began amongst the massed warriors on the far bank. They moved forward in two thick columns, swarming into the water. And Hassan exclaimed mildly, "They carry no weapons."
"They are naked," added Omar, and his terror ebbed, and was replaced by an erotic interest as he watched the black columns move out into the shallows. Like the horns of a buffalo, they circled one of the sandbanks, and though the chest-deep water hampered them, yet the maneuver was completed before the old bull hippopotamus woke from his gargantuan slumber to find himself surrounded. He lumbered to his feet and glared about him with his piggy, pink eyes. 5 tons of solid flesh, clad in a thick grey hide, splotched with pink upon the belly. His legs were short, thick and powerful, and when he opened his jaws to bellow, he exposed great yellow fangs of ivory, which could bite a war canoe in half. He broke into a cumbersome gallop, leaving deep hoof prints in the soft white sandbank, and he charged at the wall of black bodies that cut him off from the deep pool of the river. He entered the shallows, churning up a wake of foaming white water, while ahead of him the black wall solidified and thickened as the line bunched up to receive and absorb his charge. The bull then went into them at full gallop, and human bodies were flung about like chaff in the whirlwind. His jaws clashed as he chopped at them, and when he drove forward it seemed that nothing could stay such devastating power. He must burst through them and find safety in the deeps of the river, yet they swarmed about him, from the sides and rear, and his charge slowed perceptibly. Although his bellows seemed louder, and the champing of ivory tusks cutting through living flesh carried clearly to the watchers on the island. Manatasi stood quietly, leaning forward slightly, with a small frown upon his scar-riven brow, and his eyes were yellow and watchful. In the river, the water creamed and flashed and sparkled. The bull's bellows took on a new note, a hint of panic, and he was no longer visible beneath the swarming naked bodies. It was like a scorpion attacked by army ants, creatures only a small fraction of his size, smothering him with their numbers. The sunlight glittered on the wet bodies, and the bull's forward progress was arrested. He was transformed into a struggling ball of human bodies, while around him the water turned dark brown with blood, and the mauled bodies fell away like poisoned black ticks from the body of an ox. They floated down on the sluggish current, while others swarmed forward eagerly to replace them. Now, miraculously, the striving knot of men and beast began to move towards the island. Leaving the debris of death behind them, they moved slowly through the shallows. They reached the island and came from the water. 1,000, perhaps 2,000 men, carrying the exhausted but still struggling hippopotamus bodily from the river and up the bank. The bull slashed viciously from side to side, and all within reach of his jaws died, while the bull's head and the inside of his mouth was clotted with the bright blood of his victims. Leaving a thick trail of dead and terribly maimed men behind them, they carried the bull to where Manatasi stood waiting. The war captain came forward unsteadily. He was weak from loss of blood, for he had lost one arm above the elbow, taken away by a single bite of those terrible jaws. He handed a stabbing spear to his king. Manatasi walked forward, and while his men held down the terrified monster, he stabbed it in the throat. Finding the jugular vein with the first thrust, the bull died in a burst of dark blood and a cry that rang against the hills. Manatasi stepped back and watched impassively as his men dispatched their wounded with swift mercy, and when the war captain came and knelt before him, clutching the severed stump of an arm to his chest, and begged for the honor at the hand of his king. A bright pride burnt briefly in Manatasi's eyes. He made the mercy stroke, crashing the man's skull with a single blow of the iron claw, and then he walked back and smiled bleakly as he saw the sheikh's amazement.
"That is my answer," he said.
And after a while, Hassan asked, "What do you want of us?"
"Two things," Manatasi replied. "An undefended passage of the river through your territory for my armies. You must forsake your pact of mutual defense with Opet. And I want iron weapons. My smiths will take another 10 years to arm so many men. I want weapons from you.
In return, you will deliver to us the gold of Opet and the mines of the Middle Kingdom?"
"No, no," Manatasi snarled angrily. "You may take the gold. I have no use for it. It's a cursed metal, soft and useless. You may take all that Opet has, but," and he paused, "the mines of the Middle Kingdom will never be worked again. No more will men go down die unnaturally in the earth."
Hassan wanted to protest. Without the gold of the Middle Kingdom, his own reason for existing would vanish. He could imagine the rage of the Chan Emperor denied his trade routes with the land of gold. Omar's fingers warned him gently, their soft, insinuating touch speaking clearly.
There will be another time to argue. And Hassan heeded the warning, and he choked back the protest. And instead he smiled at Manatazi.
You will have your weapons. I will see to it.
When? Demanded Manatazi.
Soon, soon, promised Hassan. As soon as my ships can return from the land across the eastern seas.
Lannan had aged these last few years, Hui thought. Yet the change was flattering. The new lines that care had chiseled dispelled the prettiness from his features and had given him dignity. Around the mouth there was the same petulance, the pout of the spoilt child. But one had to look closely to find it. His body was as young and hard as it ever had been. And as he stood now, stark naked in the bows, in the attitude of the harpooner, every muscle in his back and shoulders stood out clearly beneath the oiled skin. The sun had gilded his body to a dark honey gold, and only his buttocks were a creamed ivory where his breech clout had protected them. He was a beautiful creature, favored beyond all others by the gods, and Hui compared this body to his own and felt despair within him. Words began to form in his mind, a song to Lannan, an ode to his beauty. As he poled the skiff silently and smoothly over the still waters of the lake, the words tumbled about in his mind like wind-blown leaves. Then they began to fall into patterns, and the song was born. In the bows, Lannan signaled with his free hand, without looking around, still poised, staring down into the waters, and Hui turned the skiff with an expert thrust of the pearl. Suddenly, Lannan's body unleashed its pent-up energy in a fluid, explosive thrust, an uncoiling of tensed muscles as he hurled the long harpoon down through the surface. The water bulged and swirled, and the line coiled in the bottom of the skiff began tearing out over the side, hissing away into the water. "Ha!" shouted Lannan. "A fair thrust! Help me, Hui!" And together they jumped to the line, laughing with excitement and then swearing at the pain of scorched fingers as the line ran through them. Together they slowed the heavy run of the fish. The skiff was moving out into the lake as the fish sought the deep water, dragging them with it.